Today is Wednesday. It's May 1st, 2024, and it's 2:41 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. Welcome to the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends. Give us a good rating and email the Rascals, John Williams, at WGNradio.com. I'll share some of your email and we'll respond to them. At the end of today's pod, you can hear parts of this broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8 o'clock and listen for me live weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former reporter columnist from Chicago and now doing the Chicago history blog, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Marge Halperin, an award-winning journalist and communications consultant. I have a few decades of political experience. I'm currently featured on Canada's CTV, and I'm an all-around expert at challenging authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, former Tribune columnist, and I write the award-worthy Picayune Sentinel Substack newsletter.
Okay, you and I don't have fancy bumper stickers. We got to come up with a line.
No, I've never won anything. Nothing.
And I'm not known
hearts
for anything.
Hearts and minds.
Will you share some of your awards with us so we can have something for our mantles, Marge? I did win one of the Father of the Year contests from the Illinois Fatherhood Association, an award they give out in order to get publicity for their organization.
But
I do have that. And when the kids give me any gas, I'll just bring out and check the award. Look, have you won an award for being a child? No, you have not. Hush up.
That's definitive.
Well, CNN calls them pro-Palestinian protesters, but Fox News today called them anti-Israeli protesters. So which is it? I had a fast, disagreeable conversation with a listener on the air today who said that the purpose of these protests on college campuses across the country is to promote the killing of the Jews and eliminating their state. I said I don't believe that. She said that this isn't an organic movement. It's organized by forces beyond the campuses. And I said, I think it is indeed a genuine reflection of the people on campus who want the war to stop. She said, well, then where do you think they're getting all of the same tents? I didn't have a fast answer to that, but I do today. What would be the right chyron, if you will, Marge? What should it say across the screen when they're showing a protest on one of these campuses?
You know, I think you have to use the words they put forward. We try to characterize it, or external forces try to characterize them with various motivations. I think Eric had said last week and frequently that some of the language is disturbing. But also some of the responses are disturbing. I think what happened in New York with riot police was extraordinary, and I'm not sure it was called for. There's a lot to unravel, but the campuses that are doing this successfully are initiating conversation about some of the demands, and some of the demands are not unreasonable, to talk about disinvestment of the universities, the ones that are flat out hateful are unreasonable, and that language is very disturbing. If there's a real honest chyron at the bottom, it says nation struggles to understand what's happening on college campuses.
My take on this is that there are certainly some of those protesters are extremely anti-Semitic. There are a number of more of them who are anti-Zionist, who feel as though, and I'm just saying this is what their argument is that in 1948, or thereabouts, that land was taken from the people who lived there. And there were hundreds of thousands who were displaced when Israel was formed. And then the question is, was that just a sort of a form of colonialism where they came and they took over, or colonizing, where they took over a land and now they should give it back? And they don't necessarily want the Jews in Israel dead. They just want them off of Israel. They want them back in Europe or over in the United States or wherever they want to go. That's what they want. I think it's a very, very small number of those protesters who actually would want to see Jews killed. So I don't think it's fair to what your listener said, John. Doesn't seem fair to me in terms of assessing that. But it does seem to me that there's that element. And then there's the element of people that I might side with, which says, like, knock it off, you guys. Stop killing each other. And it's like when you separate kids who are fighting. Like, I don't care who started it. I want it to stop. I want you guys to figure this out. And I want, you know, the mass killing, 35,000 Palestinians killed, the 1,000 plus Israelis who were killed by the Hamas on October 7th. I mean, those are both atrocities, and we just can't keep committing atrocities to try to make that work. We've got to get those hostages back. We've got to sit down and find peace. And I think that's where a lot of these protesters are coming from. They want to see the killing of innocent people stopped, and so maybe calling them pro peace activists or pro ceasefire activists is more accurate.
That would then describe what I hope or think is the majority of the campus protesters. They just want the bombing to stop. They're not pro Hamas. I don't even know that they've thought so much about the colonial considerations that you just referenced. That's another chapter maybe that we're not all on right now. I think mostly, I mean, this is the way I read it. This is the way I was hoping that was all about, is these idealistic young people just want the killing to stop. That's the message. I think it gets mischaracterized sometimes. We talked a little bit about this last week and more so on the radio today, but who are those people and what is their message? Maybe it depends on the campus. It's been hard to discern. The New York Police Department, where you wondered if that wasn't a bit much. Are you talking about the city police pulling the kids off the Columbia campus yesterday and arresting a couple hundred of them? And some of my listeners felt that that was a model of efficiency. You warn them, you tell them we're coming, you come in strong, and you remove the problem.
Well, what I read was that they used a ladder to ram through the windows and break into the Hamilton Hall where the students were and get them out. I don't know what efforts there were to have dialogue. First, I, considerably milder, participated in a sit-in when I was in college. Students went on strike to support staff demands, and we sat in the dean's office. But, you know, finally they picked some leadership, took them back in the office, had a conversation, and we all agreed to leave. Like, I don't know how. I think the police escalate things when they do that. I understand on a private college, there are different free speech regulations or policy laws that the students need to follow, policies, not laws. You know, so it's a different on a campus there versus, say, UCLA, where I think they have to behave a little differently. But it's disturbing. Any of us who have a memory of the campus protests of the 60s, or at least know the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song and understand National Guard would be a disaster, I think, on any college campus. And I would hope that doesn't happen, but I expect it will in Texas if it hasn't already, actually, because they've been talking about it. De-escalation. It's funny. We keep talking about de-escalation of police response in a lot of contexts. And I think it fits here, too. I don't think it is a job of police to preserve order, not disorder.
My understanding is that they cleared that building on the Columbia campus without any particular incident. Like, nobody, as far as I know, no one was hurt. And those students were breaking the law. I mean, it wasn't a police riot or anything like that. I don't think they had to beat anybody up. And at some point, you know, they're camping out, but I think they were finding that just camping out and giving speeches and having a little, you know, having your demonstration doesn't get the response that you want. And Neil Steinberg today wrote his column saying that campus administrators should just ignore the students who are camped out on their quads.
Yeah,
and
I say, wonder
you know,
about
go
that.
Go ahead, camp out, which makes some sense to me. But when you do that, you're not giving them the response that they want. They're going to keep escalating it until they make you respond. And so that they're going to take over a building. I guess they were vandalizing that building. So at some point, if you come in and your police response is firm but not violent, it seems excusable to me. I mean, I'm not sure what Columbia is supposed to do. I mean, if you're the president of Columbia, Marge, do you just say, well, occupy this building, shut down the campus for as long as you like? Or do you say, we're going to reward this behavior of yours by giving you what you want? I'm not sure. I don't know how many, you know, what does that represent? How many students are there? Does it represent a majority of Columbia students? How do you make a decision like that when you got people who are just like having a fit? They're saying we're not going to leave this. We're going to keep disrupting until you give us what we want. That's not how things are supposed to work, is it?
Well, have they had any direct conversations? Have they sat down with leadership of the protest to talk about what they want, to see what potential common ground there might be, which is what we're asking, actually, Palestinians and Israelis to do, to talk it through? And the most troubling thing about this for me is the impact it's going to have on this election, because I'm laser focused on making sure we don't have another Trump presidency. And I think this is something's got to be resolved here. And the action I'd like to see would come from the White House.
Letting the encampments go on and on, though, the way they've been at places like Columbia. I mean, where it's quiet and it's peaceful, as it apparently is at DePaul, for instance, it sounds like they're not causing any trouble. And at Northwestern, they were also calm and peaceful. Not big problems at U of C yet. So far, we've been lucky, right? But over at Columbia and at UCLA, as we know, it was already getting very sketchy over there. I mean, not just from little glimpses of social media videos, but clearly I would say from the coverage I was seeing, it seemed like there was definitely a very intimidating and unsafe atmosphere going on over at Columbia. And let's not forget, those students broke into that building. They didn't just open the door and walk in and sit down. They broke windows to get into that building.
It started to look like January 6th.
Yeah, and then built barricades. So I actually think Columbia probably did do the right thing. And let's face it, the Columbia president, no matter which way she went on this, was probably going to be drawing fire no matter what she did.
Right. We talk about DePaul and how it's a very peaceful demonstration there. If they just sit there and camp out on the quad or wherever they are at DePaul and pass out leaflets and chant and pound drums or whatever it is they're doing there. And, you know, I got to say, I sort of hate this conversation in a way, because it seems to gloss over what they're protesting and how awful that is and what awful things are going on over there. And we're talking about it in these terms of tactical things and talking about how childlike some of these protesters are. I think they're very sincere, a lot of them, in wanting peace. So all that said, I think you're going to see some of these demonstrations that are now peaceful are not going to get the response they want, that they want. To cause, I mean, the ones at Columbia, they were hanging out in the whatever the central campus area is, and they weren't getting the rise out of the administration that they wanted. They weren't getting the concessions they wanted, so they escalated, and they would continue to escalate. And I get it, as a protest, a matter of protests are about attracting attention. Otherwise, you'd just be on your computer sending angry emails to people, right? You're out there trying to get attention for your cause, and the way you get attention is you disrupt things. We talked about this with blocking the route to O'Hare. And the question is, what does that attention end up doing? What is the net effect of it? I worry, like Marge does, about what it's doing to Joe Biden. And I hear some of these students interviewed, and they say, you know, I don't care about lesser of two evils. I will never vote for Genocide Joe. And I'm thinking, you poor idiots. I mean, seriously, you poor, stupid idiots.
But what if their protest worked? What if the protest worked and it got the administration to cease funding to Israel?
Then that would be great. I mean, I'm not going to take a side on that issue. I haven't really studied that, but it would be an effective thing to do. My question is, if they're saying that we're not going to vote for Joe Biden because we think, you know, we don't care, or we think Donald Trump is just as bad. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, I think our country is really on a knife edge right now with its future. And you read that article, we haven't talked about this, but the interview with Trump in Time magazine,
yeah,
where he goes on and on about all these things he's going to do. I mean, that guy's going to disrupt American democracy perhaps forever. And here we are, you know, saying, well, Joe Biden is funding Israel, isn't being tough enough with Israel. Fine, you can have problems with Joe Biden. I don't agree with everything Joe Biden does or says either. But my goodness, the ignorance of people who don't seem to think that this election really matters. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know that. But I was talking to somebody who was somewhat sympathetic to the tactics that these kids are using. And they felt that the issue is not just like you're saying, that the U.S. election, presidential election, trumps everything. And genocide is a pretty big thing, too, right? That's worth your protest. That's worth risking maybe some consequences that you don't want, because this is also a very laudable goal. We've got to get the U.S. to stop aiding Israel. We've got to get the bombing to stop. We've got to get the schools to divest, if that's a way to pressure them into pulling out of Israel.
You know, in terms of divesting, there was a time when corporations and ultimately, I think the U.S., but states and others certainly stopped or divested from South Africa. Right? So there's a precedent for that and there's an impact for it. But I just think the message from the campuses is really not to the presidents of the colleges. It's to the president of the country who keeps warning Israel. And, you know, what Eric just said applies to that, too. You can't just keep making threats and not following through. You have to have a response or they're going to escalate. Didn't Netanyahu say this week that if we could work out a ceasefire, but we're still going to devastate Rafah?
With or without a release, yeah.
That's right. Why are we, give us the hostages and then we'll kill more people. How can our country not take a firmer stand against that? That's what would calm down the campuses.
Well, yeah, the South African divestment movement is a good case in point there, Marge, but it was not too difficult to get everybody on board with that, whereas this is a very divisive issue.
Well, of course, one of the things is that the investments of these private universities are opaque, and we don't know what they're invested in. If you know, you're invested in you know, companies that are building bombs and so on, that's a little different than investing in universities or businesses that are in Israel, that there is something deeply anti-Zionist about. I mean, if you're trying to pull money out of Israel, what are you trying to force them to do? I mean, and I'm not even sure that if you added up all the campus investments in Israel, it would amount to much of anything, truly, in the scope of things. But as a symbolic gesture, it is.
Well, that's it. Yeah. They just want to punish him. They just want to punish him. That's just that's the punch you can throw.
To the point of they have to keep escalating to get attention for their cause. It reminds me of the letter that the University of Chicago president sent out as a response to their encampments. You guys know we have institutional neutrality. We do not take sides on issues, period. But we're going to let this encampment be here for a little bit, as long as it's not too disruptive, because we want to see your free speech, et cetera. And he said, I believe the protesters should consider that an encampment with all the etymological connections of the word to military origins is a way of using force of a kind rather than reason to persuade others. And then at the end, he said, I ask the students who have established this encampment to instead embrace the attitude of other skills at their disposal. Seek to persuade others of your viewpoint with methods that do not violate policies or disrupt the functioning of the university and the safety of others. Why should not their goal be to be talking to people and persuading them that their ideas are correct? I don't understand why that seems to be okay as a goal to try and force people to agree with them rather than to be.
What do you mean force people to agree? You mean talking about the physical presence on campus and all of the, who's forcing somebody to do something?
I feel that a lot of these things, like blockading O'Hare, for instance, things like that, are not about trying to
persuade people.
Yeah. That their side is correct, explaining why they are correct and trying to persuade people.
That's pretty soft, Kate. Sometimes you got to inflict a little pain. You got to make them miss their flights. You've got to make them miss their classes. That's the attitude you're up against.
It's not right. You should be actually trying to have conversations.
I don't think you're going to talk somebody out of their position on this issue, though.
That just speaks to how divisive the issue is.
So one of my colleagues is Jewish at the radio station, and he was talking to me today on the air about how his kids are going to college, and he's paying money for them to go live and learn on that college campus. And if the protests are keeping his Jewish kids from accessing a building or feeling safe on that campus, he is very defensive about that. He is very angry about that. And if somebody is shouting from the river to the sea or just making the campus that he's paying a lot of money for his kids to go to school a hostile place for them to live and try and learn, he'd like a little consideration here. Maybe we should take the tents down. Maybe we should forcibly remove those kids because it is an impediment to his children. I was glad that he said that. That's a fair point for us all to consider, to think about, to be aware of. What about them? What about that?
I fail to see how anyone at this point cannot know that From the River to the Sea is taken by many people to be okay. a genocide against Jews slogan. But I do think that since there is an argument to be made that it doesn't mean that I'm okay with the colleges not banning a slogan like that, as long as it's not being done in a way that's like being shouted directly at Jewish students.
Sort of the attitude Kim Fox is taking.
Is there anything, do you think, to my question or observation that anti-Zionism is not necessarily an anti-Semitic or certainly not a desire to see Jews eradicated or the idea of genocide against the Jews, that you can say, we want this land back. We don't care where you go. We just want the land back. We want the property that we had in 1948 back. And From the River to the Sea, Jewish identity and Zionism is all tied up in a very complicated way for a lot of Jews, I know. My wife is Jewish, so we've talked about this certainly before. And so, I mean, I guess I just don't feel like there is actual like malice in the hearts of these protesters, most of them toward Jewish people. I think that their sympathy for the Palestinians overflows, and it also vastly oversimplifies the history of that region, where it was once Judea, right? The Jewish history there goes back thousands of years. It's not just 1948. So, I mean, it's very, very complicated, and it seems like it's a real learning opportunity, and the college campuses would be a great place to hash this out without threats of violence or people feeling like they're being made unsafe. And that if I were a parent of a student at one of these schools, I'd be mad that they're not learning more about the situation rather than just chanting slogans and linking arms.
Part of that is behind a protest. You're right, Kate. It's one thing if they're trying to force others to agree, but I think peaceful protest at the heart of it is about raising awareness. If you do it on the highway to O'Hare, you do it on a college campus, we should not assume that others, that the vast majority of people in this country are even as well informed as we are, although we are showing that there's a lot we don't know and understand as well. But we'd like to see those conversations happen in a informative way, and that's what college campuses are about. And I think there's nothing wrong with peaceful protest. When it's peaceful, when it's not, it there needs to be a response. But this question about whether it's okay to use those slogans if you don't really mean it in a bad way, almost, I don't want to oversimplify my reaction to what you said, Eric, but From the River to the Sea means maybe a harmless thing for some people, but Hamas uses that as a desire to eradicate the Jewish population. When I was in college, at Michigan, I was in a dorm that had a lot of Jewish students. I'm not sure why. I mean, it wasn't a religious
form. Alice Lloyd?
Alice Lloyd was my dorm. Exactly right. It was a progressive place, and Jews tend to be progressive.
Go blue.
There we were. But we, in 73, the Yom Kippur War, we had a bomb threat every night for about a week, and we were vacated. We were in danger, or it seemed we were. There never was a bomb, but, you know, that kind of action needs a response. That's not what's happening now. But there have been some altercations with Jewish students. But to this day, I don't wear my religion on my sleeve because I often don't feel fully comfortable.
I'm sure that most of the college students who are yelling From the River to the Sea don't mean it in a genocidal way and are not fully aware that it is a Hamas slogan and that is what they mean by it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why you can't ban it.
Well, they know it's provocative, it's not helpful.
I completely agree. And yet you have to go along for free speech purposes. You have to pretend that even the ones who mean it don't mean it, right? Because so many don't actually mean it.
There's probably no answer to this, but I wonder what the message is, because there's different campuses and different populations on the campuses. But are these protests across the country about just ending the war in Gaza, or are they about a two-state solution, or that the Jewish people have to vacate Israel? Eric, you keep bringing that part of the equation up. I've been more reading this or processing this as pressuring the administration to stop helping Israel and for Israel to stop ending the war. That's what this was about.
That's how I read it. But I think that there are a number of different factions in these protest groups, and some of them want Israel to not exist anymore, and they don't care what happens to the Jews who are there. They
okay.
should go back to wherever their ancestors came
so,
from.
So, Eric, how much attention should they get, though? I wonder if the media isn't giving them more than they deserve.
I think that the groups themselves ought to ostracize and ban the people who are waving Hamas flags. Hamas is a terrorist organization.
Sure.
And what they did on October 7th, and I know that what's happened since then in some ways has dwarfed that atrocity, but that was, they broke a ceasefire and they went and they killed and they did all, it was horrible attacks on civilians in Israel. It was an enormous and grotesque war crime. And so to wave their flag, it would be like having a racial harmony protest and having somebody waving a Confederate flag. I mean, just get those people out of there. Those people are not speaking for your cause. They're confusing your cause. When you're chanting about burn Tel Aviv to the ground, when those things are toxic, I don't think they advance your cause at all. I think you need to fine tune your message. And I agree with the message that says, let's stop this fighting. Let's return those hostages. Let's settle this. Let's figure if a two-state solution, we've got to make that work, because those people aren't going anywhere. The Jews aren't going anywhere, and the people, residents of Gaza, aren't going anywhere. So let's figure out a way that they can live side by side on this earth rather than killing each other all the time. Let's figure that out. And that's a legitimate demand, and demanding that the United States do as much as it can to advance that, including dissuading Netanyahu from what's going on in Rafah. And I mean, we have to use what muscle, what influence we have to do that. I'm all for that. But when you're allowing into your movement these people who are, like I say, waving Hamas flags and spouting these slogans that are evil, then your message is not going to get across.
Well, do you think the U.S. should cut its financial ties to Israel? Should we put more pressure? Are we doing enough?
We are not.
I don't think we are.
But I do think we hear Biden talked to Netanyahu yesterday, day before, and laid down the law or took a hard line or whatever. It's not changing anything. So I do think the U.S. needs to escalate our response to show that we want this to stop. The national polls show the majority wants it to stop. And I will also say, as a Jewish person, I totally reject what Netanyahu is doing. And I think a lot of Jews in this country and around the world agree that he is not helping the Jewish cause. He's not making, and I've said this before, he's not making our lives safer here or anywhere around the world as he continues to take this hard line. But I don't think he's got an incentive to stop. He apparently doesn't, because he's promising still to invade Rafah. We don't want this. I don't want this in my name. And the U.S. doesn't want it in our name or with our money and our munitions.
It's a perfect reason to protest, even though I'm one of those people who I think there probably is a pretty big percentage of us who's still as horrified as we are with the military action in Gaza, still a little conflicted about how it is that Israel is supposed to go forward.
Israel squandered a window after the 7th when the world was in horror at what Hamas has done. And now Israel is overshadowed. I mean, I don't want to say that exactly. There's no overshadowing the horror of that day, but they've inflicted their own horror and they've lost public opinion. It was a terrible PR move, and apparently not a very effective military move either.
Yeah.
But how do you, Eric, sit down and negotiate and figure out how to resolve this? Of course, if anybody knew how, it would have been done decades ago, so we're not going to come up with it now. But when you're dealing with Hamas, and Palestinians have not renounced their Hamas leadership.
Eric's the one that said, you grab them by the ear and you sit them down and you say, now you guys stop it.
I don't know what hasn't been tried over there, but it does. The two-state solution seems inevitable and obvious.
Yeah.
The only alternative is to continue the way we have been, which isn't working either.
another week has come and gone, and Marge Halperin still feels the same way she did last week about a football stadium. In her op-ed for the Chicago Tribune, Marge, you concluded, "The more details we learn, the more we see. The city does not seem to have followed any of the four key steps to securing a fair deal for taxpayers." This was our principal conversation last week. Anything else needs to be said about that? What were the four big pillars, Marge? Give me the elevator speech on what you said in the Tribune this week.
Yeah. First of all, just slow down. The Bears are in a big hurry. Of course they are. If they can get this done before we look any more closely at what a bad deal it is for taxpayers, they win, because the more we know, the worse it looks for us. So that is certainly the first point. The second point is get independent analysis. We are relying on the Bears to tell us how many jobs will be created, how much economic impact there will be, even how much we're going to spend on developing this site for them. None of that is proving to be true as we get more analysis. But the city's job is to do an independent analysis, not only of what the Bears propose, but of alternatives. Why did they reject Michael Reese as a valid site? They say it's too narrow. Well, I've seen proposals related to Michael Reese, and I think there'll be more public conversation about that before too long. There is definitely a viable plot there for them. What is their analysis, and how did the city allow them to so quickly reject that alternative? So anything that they say is about getting us to make the billionaire owners richer. Another point would be community input. I don't like how the city has been doing business of late, not just Johnson, but Lightfoot with the casinos. And there's other examples where they hammer out a deal and then they announce it's done and they hold a so-called public hearing where you could fill out a card and turn it in and they might read it or they might not if they don't like what you say. There's no meaningful engagement of the communities that would be impacted. The other point is about tax extensions. And I pull this out separately because the idea is that there's no new taxes. You know, he did a read my lips thing, Mayor Johnson did, when in fact, this is extending a 2% hotel motel tax and extending the bonds for Soldier Field for another 40 years.
Brandon Johnson needs a win, doesn't he? I mean, that guy just has not caught a break. Maybe they are self-inflicted wounds, but then at the funeral for Officer Luis Huesca this week, he was specifically asked not to attend. J.B. Pritzker was asked not to attend. J.B. Pritzker didn't attend. Mayor Johnson sent some staff members to, I guess, represent his office and the city's concern, but the police officer's mother said that she didn't feel like the mayor was sufficiently in support of the police and specifically asked him not to show up. Brandon Johnson needs a win.
And now he's gone silent.
Yeah.
We have to remember, to your point, Marge, this is the culmination of secret meetings to negotiate this. They started having meetings with him immediately after his inauguration. So he has spent literally the entire past year having secret meetings with the Bears instead of doing it in public transparently. It's unfortunate, but he's actually been cooking this up the entire year. So,
and it's a predictable result. He took the Bears' analysis, the Bears' estimates, the Bears' guarantees, and the media luckily has been doing what the city should have done and showing us that, you know, Johnson bragged about getting a public benefit, you know, the public playing field that high schoolers and others can be on. Well, that's not in the initial budget, A, and B, we have to pay for that. The Bears CEO, Warren, was clear this first phase of infrastructure, it's only $350 million, but it's crucial. That'll build his dome stadium. The whole rest of it, he doesn't even care about. You could do phase two and three if you want. Well, that's where we get the public benefit. Not only that, but it does look like all of the money the Bears put into this, their skin in the game, which is the mayor's other boast, they'll get back because they've negotiated the naming rights for the new stadium. And they've negotiated, apparently, a heavy cut, if not all, of the revenue from other activities that happen in that stadium. Beyonce comes back, they make the money. Right now, the Park District makes that money. So you talk about no new taxes, it's going to put a hole in the Park District's budget.
I'm really persuaded by Marge's argument, and others have made the same point, which is like, if our local economy or the tourist economy can absorb this 2% extra on that adds up to 17%, the hotel operator's tax, if that can work, if we can charge that and get away with it, that money that we're talking about to build a stadium could go toward replacing lead pipes. It could go toward boosting education, mental health care, fire, police, all the urgent needs that we have, the city pensions, city health care, all the stuff that are much more pressing than building a new stadium for a team. So it isn't free money. And if you don't use that money for those purposes, then you're going to have to raise other taxes to pay for them. And so this idea that it's all going to be done magically and no one's going to have to pay for it, which is kind of what Mayor Johnson was saying last week, is just, what would Joe Biden say? Malarkey is what it is. It's malarkey. Can you say malarkey on WGN?
Yes, we can. That one is permitted.
And politically, this isn't a starter right now. You can tell, it's just every news report I read out of Springfield, the governor is very cool on this. It seems like Don Harmon, the Senate president, is very lukewarm, and over in the House, there, you know, Chris Welch is not throwing his support behind it. And these are people you have to have, like, seriously behind it, because you're going to have to drag a bunch of people with you to get them to vote to dedicate this money. And it's just, it's not going to happen, and it shouldn't happen quickly. The Bears want it done in May. It's not going to happen in May, and thank goodness it isn't, because last time this happened, which was less than 25 years ago, when the Bears rammed it through, it was in the year 2000, and we were all distracted by the recount in Florida, the Gore versus Bush recount in Florida, and down in Springfield, they're like clearing their throats and quietly approving this stadium deal. And yeah, it got covered, but we weren't focused on it the way we are now. This isn't going anywhere now, and it may never go anywhere. And I wish the Bears would look to Michael Reese's site. They would look to Arlington Heights. I don't care where they play. The idea that it's got to be in the lakefront, I don't understand that at all. It's like, what, so that the cameras can show the stadium in the lakefront? I just don't see it happening politically. I don't see why Mayor Johnson doesn't cut his losses, or why he didn't see this coming. What's one of the things that's a broader question about Brandon Johnson is he doesn't see around corners very well.
Yeah.
And to get to this funeral issue that you brought up earlier, John, it's like, clearly his relationship with police, even though he gave them a big raise the last time, his relationship with police is fraught. And he's got to think, somebody in his administration's got to say, Brandon, let's think about this. Do we want to go to this funeral? What kind of look is that going to be? Let's talk to the family. Let's talk to John Catanzaro. Let's figure out what this is going to be. Because the last thing you want is to create a scene, you know, the officers turning their back on the mayor, which has happened in New York, I know, for instance. You don't want that. This is about this young man who was cut down tragically. It's a terrible thing. And you just don't want to distract from that tragedy by going there for some political reason to show that you're a sensitive, caring mayor. That's crap. Can we say crap on a podcast?
Well, but I don't think that if the mayor had an intention to go to that funeral, I don't know that that was for a political reason.
John.
What other reason would there be?
That's what your job is. You're the mayor. You're in charge of all of these people that work for the city. The buck stops there. If one of your officers is killed in the line of duty, you don't think it's appropriate for the mayor to be there? Suppose the mother wanted him there.
But when you hear from the very beginning that the family doesn't want you there, that's it. It is their funeral.
After they expressed that, Brandon Johnson yet still wanted to go to the funeral, still said, no, but I need to be there.
His office was told right away, but they kept pushing and pushing and pushing to the point where apparently the family at the last minute was being told, well, first they were told, okay, you don't want them to come, the mayor won't come. But then at the wake, they were being told, well, actually, he's required to come. You have to let him come. But this was overheard, and they were told, you know, no, that's not true. If you don't want him here, he's not going to come.
Well, that is crass.
Doesn't he have to have some sort of fingertip feel for how this city works and how his relationship with police is perceived and how police perceive him? And just thinking it through, it feels like his reaction is maybe just like John's like, this is what a mayor does. I've got to go. And not thinking we should check with the family here, because this is a tragedy. This is a human tragedy. This is not an opportunity for me to show that I care.
I just don't understand. Weren't we hearing very recently that he was getting some new people onto his communication staff? Somebody was coming.
John
from
Fetterman.
Somewhere.
John
from
Fetterman's
the Fetterman
guy.
Team. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The guy who has deep Chicago.
Everything.
Deep Chicago roots. Because he's from Naperville, right?
Well, I don't know. Is he taking a long vacation before he starts his new job or something? Because I'm not seeing any improvement here.
I'm too often seeing the mayor's office refused to comment. The mayor's office would not comment about this. I'm seeing that way too often. Mayor's offices are supposed to comment unless it's an extremely personal matter or a personnel matter. You've got to have comment. You're the mayor. That's your job. And a communications person, his job is to communicate. And I think he's got a real uphill climb if he wants to be reelected. He does have 3 more years. He hasn't even been in office.
Yeah. Well,
he's put a lot of feet wrong in the last year.
Maybe he should comment on whether or not the state of Illinois should provide Wegovy. Should the state of Illinois insurance programs, the programs that work in the state of Illinois, cover those weight loss drugs? I'm reading from a story in the Sun Times. J.B. Pritzker's office pushed to expand coverage of high-priced weight loss drugs for state government workers, a quiet maneuver that could cost Illinois taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars starting this summer. In making these highly sought-after injectable medications that would cost some people upwards of $16,000 a year, available to eligible employees in the state's group health insurance program, the J.B. Pritzker administration is seeking an estimated $210 million to fund the first full year of broadened coverage starting July 1st. Seems to me like it's a healthcare concern. That drug is ridiculously expensive. I know some people see it as a vanity drug. You just want to look thinner, but you're also healthier when you are that much thinner. Just bumped into somebody recently who had been taking the drug. I didn't realize it, one of them, but I saw him for the first time and he had dropped 80 pounds. He just said he is so much healthier. He feels so much better. It's funny, though, isn't it? Because the way these drugs work is it doesn't up your metabolism. You're not burning calories faster. It limits your appetite, and you tend to consume less, which is a means that's available to people without a drug, but they don't seem to do it. I think that's where it gets a little controversial for some people. Marge, you were going to say what?
Controversial and a little judgy, I would say, because there are a lot of reasons that people have difficulty losing weight. And even people, it's certainly not all because they eat too much, but even among people who you might think could eat less, there are various emotional reasons and physical reasons why that doesn't change their body composition. All of this is, to me, like reproductive health is between a woman and her doctor. I think this kind of health care is between a resident and their doctor, and denying care that could make people healthier when, as you're indicating, it could also save us money by not having to pay for knee replacements and diabetes treatment and other things that afflict people who are overweight. People who are trying to make themselves healthier ought to get the medication that's available, even if they aren't the super rich Hollywood type who can afford it.
My concern would be that these are still a little bit new. There are side effects. Jumping on the bandwagon that quickly for the state to pay for it, obviously will, you know, make it that much more popular, maybe a little too quickly. And when it gets up to like 80 pounds, like your friend, John, then that is really impacting every facet of your life.
Well, you wouldn't have to take it, Kate, if you didn't want to.
I mean, I'm just a little afraid that it just seems like it's snowballing really, really quickly.
And this circles back a little bit to what Marge is saying about the stadium thing. It's like, maybe we should put the brakes on, have some hearings, talk about these drugs. Kate, you probably saw the same interview I did on Bill Maher's show a few weeks ago, where they had the health expert on, or I don't know how big an expert she was, but she was casting a lot of doubt about these drugs and their long-term effects. And how, you know, when you're on, Ozempic or Wegovy, is that how you say it?
When you're
on these drugs for a long time, you have to stay on them forever. You go off them and you balloon right back up again. And But it could well be that this money, and I guess the high end of the estimates was $590 million a year.
Yeah.
But it could be that is a good investment for that the whole idea behind health insurance is that it's a good investment for a society. Yeah. And it might be that with diabetes, heart disease, joint problems, all the other things that go along with people who are overweight and morbidly obese and so on. And if you can address some of those problems, it might be that you would save money in the long run. I don't know. I don't know much about these drugs. And I don't know that the legislators who voted for it even knew about it. The stories that I was reading in Capital Facts indicated that the lawmakers who voted for it didn't even, it was like tucked into the budget bill somewhere.
Yeah, the 900-page.
And nobody knew what they were voting for, that this is the kind of thing that you don't want to do these things in haste. I mean,
there's long disclaimers at the ends of those commercials. I mean, I think any drug you take comes probably with the possibility for some side effects. I'm thinking about what Marge said, that this is just an issue. It's a healthcare issue between you and your doctor. And suppose that this drug didn't make you look a lot better. And then we wouldn't judge people for their inability to lose weight on their own or for the vanity. They just want to look better. But if we simply said this drug is going to make you healthier, and it is, then that should be sufficient reason for us to endorse it or at least help pay for it if people need it, particularly since it might end up saving us money in the long run.
But doesn't it then start to pose another question, which is, medical science is doing amazing things these days with prosthetics, with treatments, therapies, and so on. But a lot of them are really expensive. And to what degree are we just going to say that, okay, these expenses are things that we're all going to pool? We're going to all pay for them. And I happen to be someone who thinks I believe in socialized medicine or Medicare for all. I believe in that very much, strongly. But it's going to come at a pretty high price for our society when these therapies are so expensive. I don't know why Ozempic and Wegovy and those things are as expensive as they are. Maybe the price will come down ultimately when the generics come out. But when you have medical science doing the kinds of amazing things they are doing, just to expand a little bit, the school teachers at CTU, I listened to an interview with Stacey Davis Gase the other day, and she wants IVF treatments covered. I guess they're not covered by the school teachers, the teachers' contract, and also gender care, gender affirmation surgeries, and so on covered. And I guess there are other things they want covered, and those things are that's healthcare, and yet it's expensive. And to what degree is that a collective responsibility? And that's a question that we're going to face, and it's going to get more and more urgent as these really expensive things come along that can really, really change people's lives for the better.
Well, in addition to Medicare for all, I am in favor of negotiating drug prices, which Congress has resisted. But you know why the drugs are so expensive up front, because they're recouping their R&D expense and they're not allowed to have generics for a certain period of time till they supposedly make that all back. And again, what's the accounting on that? I don't know, but maybe someone else does. But I do think the way drugs are priced in this country needs to be addressed, so that it's not just the rich or super rich who can afford treatments that make them more healthy. You know the statistics about low-income families get more illnesses. They don't have access to health care. They don't have paid days off work, the whole litany. And we need to, I believe, if it's socialized medicine, so be it. I just believe more people ought to have access to good health care in this rich, rich country of ours.
And yet that's not what you see. It's not good health care. It's, oh my God, you look fabulous. It is almost like this miracle drug that people are taking, and now they look better. And they're very excited about that. And it almost doesn't feel like health care so much as it does almost cosmetic care, Marge. I think that's where some of the pushback is.
Well, let me just flip that argument. Are you going to say that a person who is heavy looks bad? Are you going to, we making these judgments on how good somebody looks based on their weight, That's a there's a whole body shaming thing. There's a whole culture in this country.
I'll ask Barbara Streisand how she feels about that. Melissa McCarthy posted a picture of her walking with another guy, and she looked great. And Lord, she's lost a lot of weight. And Barbara Streisand said, "You look great. Are you taking Ozempic?" And then the world pushed back on Barbara Streisand, saying it's inappropriate to ask her that question. Barbara said, "She's a friend. I think she looks great. I'm wondering how she did it. I'm not judging. I'm saying she looks great."
If she's a friend, ask her in private. Don't ask her what medication she's taking. She's not.
The world communicates on social media. Well, I know that, but I mean, don't you think that a motivating reason for people to take the drug isn't just because they want to improve their health, but because they do want to look better? I don't have to defend the notion in America that a thinner physique is deemed more attractive than a heavier physique. I've never said anything bad about these people's appearance, but clearly they're taking it for a reason. And it's not just because they want to be healthier. It's because they want to look better. They'll feel better about themselves. Right, Marge?
That's an individual judgment. How you feel about yourself. I think people need to do whatever they can do, whether it's drugs or counseling or whatever the avenues are, to feel good about themselves. But the judgmental part, that somehow we shouldn't be paying for this drug because some people might take advantage of it and do it just for vanity, it's just the premise I don't buy into.
Well, I'm not arguing with you. I wouldn't deny it to them for either sake.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you wouldn't want to pay for plastic surgery for someone. So, like, I want a smaller nose,
yes.
And I'll feel better about myself.
Yes.
I mean, you don't.
Watch,
I don't
that's
think
coming.
You pay for that. But, I'm sure you could make some tangential kind of arguments that, well, it would improve their mental health if they look better and so on. But the truth is that we do have limited resources, and you're going to have to figure out how to allocate them and what's a good investment of public dollars here, too. I mean, and that's why it seems like this is the kind of thing that should not have been done in haste, but should have been done with hearings and research. And maybe it's been done elsewhere. I don't know. I have no idea. I haven't seen that in the stories. Maybe some other state or other a county somewhere has done this and they've seen XYZ results. I'd like to hear about that. I'd also like to hear more about these drugs, because I have heard, as Kate alluded to, that there are some side effects to them and that they may not be all they're advertised to be.
Well, the side effects issue, there's, steroids have a side effect, and yet millions of people are on prednisone and cortisone, because it eases back pain because of other illnesses that require that kind of treatment. And the doctor explains that to the patient, and they decide together whether to go forward with the side effects. So I don't think the side effects are necessarily a government's business. But I think the analysis from a fiscal standpoint, I like the point that you made.
Yeah.
Let's see, how much money will it save? What are the statistics of people who have to have joint replacements or diabetes treatment, which is rampant, especially in communities of color, and how we could help turn that around and how much money that would save from an insurance standpoint. And I think that's the justification. If they had slowed it down a little bit, they would have shared.
It's going awfully fast. I don't know if people are going to start feeling like they need to take this medicine without, and maybe they don't fully understand all the side effects. Not that it's really an equivalent, but you think about how OxyContin just spiraled out of control. And that's prescribed by doctors, right? Doctors can sometimes overprescribe, or people go find a doctor who will prescribe something that they've seen advertised on TV and they think they should have. Maybe they shouldn't have it. Maybe it's not good for them based on some of their other medical conditions, right? But they could probably go find somebody who will give it to them anyway.
I've been reading Empire of Pain. Empire of Pain, about the Arthur Sackler and the Sackler family, Purdue Pharma. And it's so interesting you make that point. I was just thinking about that, Kate, that say what you will about them and that story, and they deserve it all. They deserve bankruptcy and jail. But they didn't start out thinking, let's get America hooked on a drug and we'll get rich from it. They actually thought they had something that would help people enormously. Then the money got in the way, and I won't get into the whole story here, but I mean, I sure have been thinking about how that was seen almost in panacea terms for what it would do for people. You guys, we don't need to talk about this, but let's just see if we've got something here in the last minute of the podcast, and that is the Christy Nome puppy murder story. It really is something to marvel at. The South Dakota governor with the great teeth, once considered a possible running mate for Donald Trump, revealed in her new book, No Going Back, that she had to put her dog down. She got out a shotgun and she shot dead her dog one day during a hunt. And then she went and killed the goat, too. And I don't know why she killed the goat.
It smelled bad, she said.
Yeah, it did. It was
smelled like a goat.
It was a bad
I think it was a sacrifice to the Dark Lord. That's my guess.
So she shoots the dog because the dog wasn't behaving properly and it just didn't seem to be trained. And sometimes it was nipping at people. And so she got out the gun and shot it and then thought, well, while I'm shooting animals, I'll go ahead and kill the goat. She shot the goat once. That didn't do the trick. So then she went out and got another shell, shot the goat again, pushed it into a pit, and then looked up and there was a school bus. Her kids got off the bus and said, hey, where's Checkers? So that's kind of the version of the story. She reveals all of this in her new book. There goes her opportunity to be vice president. And at first, I thought, maybe this is on brand. I mean, she actually positioned it as such. She said, sometimes you've got to make tough decisions, and that's what I do. And this illustrates that sometimes it's painful to make these decisions, but she does. I wondered if that wasn't actually going to help her in some circles. If you read Rex Hupke's piece in the USA Today, the former Tribune columnist, it was a very funny faux letter from her PR team to her saying, sorry, that didn't go as well as we'd hoped it would.
Well, I'm a dog lover, and I think what she failed to realize is that a lot of hardcore Republicans are dog lovers as well. And she may have thought that this would – she knew that – it was going to own the libs, right? That the Democrats would be aghast at this, but that this has been the kind of thing that Donald Trump has done all along. I mean, that he will do or say something outrageous,
yeah,
and get Democrats and people all riled up, and then it somehow works to his advantage. And I'm thinking now of like when he talked about John McCain and his service as prisoner of war, and saying, you know, I think heroes are ones who didn't get captured, and sort of cast aspersions on John McCain's sacrifice. And you'd think, I mean, a lot of people were thinking, well, that's the end of his campaign right there. It was early in the 2016 presidential race, but people rallied around him, and they rallied around him after the Access Hollywood tape. And so the idea might have been that she was going to show that she is tough. She doesn't care what soft-hearted, dog-loving people think. But that it backfired on her because she didn't quite understand that a lot of good old boys who support Donald Trump and a lot of regular people who may vote for Donald Trump love their dogs. And if they had a situation like that, they would try really much harder to train the dog. And if they couldn't train the dog, they would put the dog up for adoption. They wouldn't put a bullet in its head. And it seems cold and sadistic. And I think she has written herself off the ticket if she was going to be considered, as people say.
In South Dakota, if an animal is deemed harmful to livestock, you get to put the animal down. I mean, she's continued to defend what happened. That was her explanation for it. But there were so many other ways to handle that. And yet I thought maybe the same way Donald Trump might imagine him being jailed for contempt might act. I mean, that would be a bad thing in a normal world, but maybe that would be seen as a positive.
One of the problems with Kristi Noem's explanation, you got to make a tough decision. That wasn't a tough thing to do. She said she hated the dog. She said the dog was having the time of its life instead of doing the job she told it to do. I mean, you know, so she portrays it not as a tough decision, but gleeful. I hated that dog. And she didn't.
And she hated the goat, too.
She hated the goat. Yes. And then she said, by the way, I've also killed a lot of horses in my day. Like, she just doubled down on it.
No, now that is nuts. Who wants to hear that you killed a horse?
Oh, now, when horses are lame or old, you'll call them that. And it'll be put down humanely. You don't shoot it in a gravel pit and toss it over. Her glee, it didn't play the way she set it. She set it up as that kind of tough decision and whatever, and I'm a farm girl and this is what I have to do. But no, people don't have to do that. And it just assaults the senses to have that imagery.
She admitted that the goat jumped so that she only wounded it,
yeah,
and had to go after it to really kill it. I mean, why would you tell people that kind of gory detail?
And so the Trump people say, yeah, she's off the list now. What would you do if you were the judge, if Donald Trump continued to violate the order to not comment on what's happening at the trial?
You know, I'm a firm believer nobody's above the law. I've been active in that national movement during, you know, all of the lead up to this. So I do not think the judge should be giving any special break to Trump because he's Trump.
Even if that's a political advantage.
I said earlier in the show, I'm laser focused on not having another Trump presidency. And I believe he would benefit politically if they put him in jail.
No, I don't think so. I think that putting him in jail will make him look weak. And this trial is already making him look weak. He looks diminished to me. And I think that there's certain parts of his base that are energized by him being on trial. But I think there are a lot of voters who are in that big mushy middle who see this man on trial and who are paying some attention to the evidence being brought forth against him and who realize there are these other charges hanging out there against him who don't want four more years of craziness. I'm kind of counting on that. Who read this article in Time magazine about all the things that he's planning to do and how he says that if red states want to go ahead and punish women who get abortions, they should go ahead and do that. It's okay with him. That he wants to take control of the Justice Department, all these things. I think they're all adding up to a diminishment in Trump's appeal. And I think at the end of the day, voters are going to come home to him. Even some of these people on college campuses who say they'll never vote for him will end up maybe taking stock of this and realizing that they've got to vote for Joe Biden.
I am not clear on if he gets thrown in jail for contempt. Does the trial just go on without him?
Well, there's a lot of defendants who are in jail when they just bring them from the jail to the courtroom and
in a jumpsuit.
Right. So it doesn't fill up the trial, which is something he would like, since he would rather not have it happen before the election. I would say if it's not going to suspend the trial, then the judge has to do what's right. If he's putting witnesses in jeopardy, which he at some point may truly do, or even jury members, then the judge might have to do that. It could open up, of course, one of the big problems people have talked about is that it could open up more avenues for them to appeal it. But
I would like to know what this judge has done in situations like this previously and what other judges in that jurisdiction do. What's the typical, when you have someone who is flagrantly violating these gag orders, what has happened to them in the past? And with Marge, it's like, he's not above the law. Just because he used to be president, he is not above the law. He's not beneath the law. He should be treated like every other defendant who does these kind of things, period.
Okay, that wraps it up. That wraps it up this week. The Mincing Rascals podcast event at Winters has sold out. It sold out right away.
It's a crowd up on the
stage. There's a rumor I heard that they're going to move it from the Jazz Club to the United Center.
I know. The idea that we've
could be in the new Dome Stadium if it were ready.
When you see the venue, you'll realize that sold out isn't really bragging too much because it's a pretty small club, but it'll be a good room. And I'm glad that it sold out quickly. I think next time we'll try and head out to Naperville or Downers Grove or one of the suburbs, but it'll be a lot of fun. Kate and Marge and Eric, thanks for joining us. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, guys. Good
job. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you later.
Adios.
Right, good time.
Bye
now. You later.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.